science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, now I have with me in studio AUT's Alan Blackman. How are you doing on this wonderful Wednesday, Alan?
Oh, it's the shortest day in all, and I think I've got the lurgy, unfortunately.
The lurgy.
Yes, the dreaded lurgy.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's encouraging that it's the shortest day, though, you know? It's sort of like from now, the days are going to be getting longer.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting closer to summer.
Absolutely, yes.
And I mean, we complain about it being cold, but really, is it that cold?
No, it's not that cold at the moment.
So
it's not that cold.
Things aren't that bad, you know? That's my hot take on the shortest day of the year, 2017. But first up today, let's talk about how researchers have developed a solar paint that can absorb water vapour and then turn it into a clean energy source. This sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Okay, so what's the biggest problem with humanity at the moment?
Oh.
What's the biggest problem that needs to be answered?
Climate change.
Yeah.
How about sort of energy?
Okay, that too. They're related, right? Am I right?
How to feed the planet and how to power the planet, basically, is probably the two biggies. So we desperately need an alternative source of energy because fossil fuels are running out, etc., etc. They are finite resource. So ideally what we want is an infinite resource, and that infinite resource is water. And we can potentially power the planet using water. It's just that we've got to find a way of being able to do that. Now, we can't really do it yet. Plants can do it brilliantly in a process called photosynthesis, so they've got it all sorted. They can turn water into oxygen.
Lucky bastards.
And there are many people beavering away in many laboratories around the world who are busy trying to answer the question of how to turn water into its component elements, hydrogen and oxygen, because as everybody who's seen a hydrogen balloon go off, when you mix the two and give it a flame, then you get an enormous amount of energy coming out of that. So And the, also the beauty of using hydrogen as a fuel is that it's absolutely clean, because what you generate then is water as the only product. So you don't get any CO2 going to the atmosphere, et cetera, et cetera. So the question then becomes, how do you turn water into hydrogen and oxygen?
Mm.
So you can do it very, very easily. You just get a battery, a couple of electrodes, and stick it in water. And then you've got a process called electrolysis, and hydrogen bubbles off at one electrode and oxygen bubbles off at the other electrode. Trouble with that is that you're generating the electricity somehow, and you only get out as much energy with the hydrogen and oxygen as you put in to split it apart anyway. So not great. So what we want really is something solar powered. So ideally you want a solar powered method of turning water into oxygen and hydrogen. And as I said, there's been a lot of work involved in this, and obviously it's going to be an extraordinarily lucrative thing, whoever cracks this first. You know, a nice way of being able to turn water into fuel. And amongst a lot of other people, a couple of guys over in Melbourne, the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, have just reported that they have made a paint which they can paint on houses, and what it will do is absorb moisture from the atmosphere, and it'll turn that moisture into hydrogen and oxygen. And that's really, really cool. So the way that they do it, they use a thing called molybdenum sulfide, which some of your listeners might recognize as being sort of a lubricant. It's also a thing called a semiconductor, which means it can absorb light, and that changes its electronic structure, and then it can do all sorts of things to water. And they mix that with titanium dioxide, which is the white pigment in paint as well, and that sort of does the same thing. It's also a semiconductor. It's well known to do this. And basically, they mix those two up into a paint, stick it on the surface, and away it goes. It's a really, really nice proof of concept, I guess. The authors have admitted that anything commercial is going to be about 5 or so years away, because what they need to do is be able to obviously collect the gases that are evolved in this particular process, and then recombine them in either a fuel cell or just direct combustion, and generate lots of energy. So very, very nice piece of work, that. And I guess it's a sort of a watch the space thing.
Wait, so can I just ask maybe a dumb question? How do they get it from the paint into becoming an energy source? Like, how does that process work?
So,
like, where does it go?
So where does what go? The water or
the high? Well, because isn't it, they're extracting the hydrogen,
yes,
right?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
So how do they get that from when it's, you know, a paint on a house or whatever? Where does
That's the problem that they've got to overcome. So they've got to find some way now of extracting the hydrogen and the oxygen. So presumably it doesn't get stuck in the paint. Mm. That's going to be an interesting thing. If it's just busy evolving gas within a paint, then your paint's going to bubble, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's not going to be ideal. So obviously this is one of the problems that they're going to have to get their heads around in order to make it a commercial viability. So basically they've sorted out the chemistry, I guess.
Okay.
And now they've got to work out sort of the exact, you know, how they're actually going to go about doing this in a practical sense.
Mm. Okay. I'm just like thinking of a house that has paint on it and like thinking about how they're going to collect this hydrogen. And I mean, I'm probably not the first person, the right person for the job to solve this problem, but I'm just like, how does that happen? How are we going to do it?
I'm sure they're thinking that as well. Because again, you can imagine this is going to be extremely lucrative. If they get this to work, then everyone's going to be painting their house with this fancy paint. And they're going to be able to power their house, you know,
totally
from paint, which is fabulous. So, very nice piece of work there.
Yeah, very cool. And so next today, today is the 69th anniversary of the demonstration of the first Microgroove LP. Can you tell me a bit more about this?
Absolutely, it is. Yes. So again, one of the great inventions, I guess, of humankind, in my estimation anyway, is the ability to be able to record sound and be able to play it back. And the first person to do that was Edison way back in 1877 when he invented the phonograph, which was a little sort of wax cylinder which you sort of rotated by hand, and then that got improved to records, I guess, as we know them, the 78 RPM records. And back in those days, sort of the 1920s, 1930s, there or thereabouts, they were big, heavy pieces of shellac, and they spun at 78 RPM, and they could contain around about 4 to 5 minutes of material on either side. So they were obviously limited in what they could do then. And again, as I say, big, heavy, brittle things, so if you drop them, they'd break. And so the task was to make a better medium for recording. And this was about the age where modern day plastics were starting to come out. And so the plastics that they were looking at in this case were things called vinyl chloride and vinyl acetate, which is why we call vinyl vinyl now, because it comes from that. And sort of in around about the 1930s, people were starting to use these sort of plastics to see if they could, number one, get more data, as it were, onto one side or onto each side of these records. And so in order to do that, they'd have to spin them more slowly. And if they spin them more slowly, then they get more rumble noise. So your fidelity goes down the slower you spin it. So, and this was to do with the very, very heavy pickups that they used to use on the old gramophones. So I guess they set their scientists to work trying to solve that problem, the problem of the heavy pickup. So they wanted a lighter pickup, and they also wanted more grooves per inch, I guess, as they called it in those days. And with the new vinyl plastics, they could fit more grooves per inch. They weren't as brittle, so you could easily get a larger number of grooves, and so therefore you're going to get more recording on either side. And in the 1930s, as I said, they started doing some work with this, and they actually did release a type of LP, but they found that with the very, very heavy pickups that it would just gouge out the grooves, and after 4 or 5 plays, the thing was gone. It was unplayable. Mm. So it took until 1948, the 21st of June 1948, 69 years ago today, there was a demonstration in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. Columbia Broadcasting Systems, or CBS as we know them now, demonstrated the first example of a real 12-inch, 33 and a third RPM LP, and they could fit 22 to 23 minutes of music on either side of this, and basically everything took off after that. So this was a really, you know,
pivotal moment
in recording history, obviously. Mm. So the first album that was released was the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, E minor Violin Concerto, a lovely piece of music. And on it goes now. And again, I was in, I guess you always call them a record shop rather than the CD shop, but I was there a couple of days ago and went downstairs and just saw this vast amount of vinyl. And I'm of the era where, prior to CDs, I guess, and so I can still remember the first LP I bought was Kraftwerk Autobahn, 19, God knows how many years ago, but oh, that's a good piece of music there. And then, of course, you go and buy everything on vinyl, and then CDs come along, and so you have to replace all your vinyl with CDs. And now it seems that the opposite's happening, that CDs are getting less and less popular in vinyl for some reason that I just do not fathom.
It's the physical aspect of having vinyl. Everything is now MP3, and you can't hold an MP3
No,
really
MP3
well.
Is evil. No.
Yeah. And that sound quality, man. Yeah. Analog all the way, man.
You don't get covers with MP3, but no, I agree. Record covers, yeah, that's about the only thing that I really miss about records is the fact that you get this lovely piece of artwork, which really was a piece of art back in the day.
Yeah.
And now it's all sort of shrunk to sort of CD size, but yeah, CDs are, I'm a CD fan, I guess. But so what was the biggest selling vinyl album of last year in Britain, anybody?
Of last year. Would it be like Adele?
No.
Something like that, like a pop album?
She was well down the list. It was a pop, well, I guess you'd call it pop in a sense. Somebody who died last year.
Oh, Prince.
Oh, the other one.
Oh, no. Oh, wait, who was the other one?
Oh,
I feel like
it
was
Shemina.
such a big year of deaths that I'm
goodness.
Like, oh, Will is throwing up his arms.
Oh, yeah.
There we
oh,
go.
Yeah, there David. We go. Oh, my God, I'm going to get in trouble for this later. I can feel it.
So Black Star was the biggest selling vinyl album in Britain last year. It sold about 50,000 copies on vinyl alone.
Wow.
And the second biggest was another death, Amy Winehouse.
Ah.
It was Back to Black. So, yeah. So, 69 years after its invention, vinyl is still going strong. And, yes, should I invest in another turntable? That's now the question.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it is kind of also an aesthetic thing as well, to just have a record player and to have, you know, your stack of your records.
And there's nothing like thumbing through records in a record store. You know, I'll give you that much, certainly. But
And so finally today on the show, we're looking at CRISPR, which is a gene editing tool that has stirred a bit of controversy lately.
Mm-hmm. Now, without going into the science in detail, because I'm not sure that I understand the science in detail, but basically, everyone knows about this molecule called DNA. And DNA is made up of essentially four components, which we're going to call A and C and G and T. And there's 3 billion of these components in a piece of our DNA, and they are arranged in particular orders, and the order in which they're arranged makes you and me, basically. So we are a product of our arrangements of these four letters. So everything about us is determined by that. So, and within these big strands of DNA, there are genes. Okay, and so genes are nothing more than particular arrangements of these four bases, as they're called, A, G, C, and T. And what we'd really like to be able to do is to get rid of the bad genes and amplify the good genes.
Mm-hmm.
So there are bad genes, there are good genes. And so a few years ago, around about sort of 2012-ish, there were a couple of women who discovered this thing called CRISPR, or utilized this thing called CRISPR, because CRISPR is a natural molecule, and a thing called CRISPR-Cas9, which basically allows you to cut pieces of DNA at specific places, with absolute specificity. And so, in other words, that means you can target particular pieces of DNA, target particular genes, cut them out, replace them with other ones, etc., etc. So this is a very new technique. It is absolutely revolutionary, and every year since then, when the possible Nobel laureates come up, these two are always amongst them. They will get a Nobel Prize for this. It's pretty much a given. It's that revolutionary. Mm. And so the problem now is that they've done some amazing things with animals with this. For example, they have restored the sight of blind mice simply by treating them with this CRISPR and taking out a bad gene that leads to macular degeneration, which, you know, quite amazing. And now, obviously, the end result is that you're going to want to use this on humans. Apparently, in China, they've already used this on fetuses. I believe they've done some sort of preliminary human work in China. There's a paper that's just been published in the past month in Nature Methods, which calls into question the specificity of this whole CRISPR thing. So, as I said, you're relying on this molecule cutting DNA at a particular point and nowhere else. Okay, you can't go willy-nilly cutting DNA all over the show, because then you're going to get mutations and you're going to get unintended consequences, which is exactly what these workers have reported in this very, very recent paper. They had done some mouse studies, and what they found was that in addition to the DNA being cut at the right place, you were also getting a lot of mutations apparently at other places. And so what this has done has been to really severely dent the stock market price of three companies who are involved in CRISPR, who've raised between them $1 billion in research money looking into CRISPR, and they've just seen their share price drop, as I say, by 30 or 40%. And they're very, very upset about this because they reckon that the paper itself is flawed, fundamentally flawed, and so they've sort of put out press releases saying, no, don't believe this, don't believe this, the paper is full of errors. They only found this effect on two mice. It was a study of two mice, which, as any statistician will tell you, two is a very, very small number of N. And so the question is, would this be reproducible on a larger scale? Is it in fact correct? Is it a statistical artifact? We don't know yet. But, you know, the question is out there. So if it is true, then it's going to put this whole CRISPR thing on its head, and it's going to set it back an awful lot, I would say, an awful, awful lot. Certainly in terms of, you know, potential human trials and stuff like that, people won't touch it, I would imagine.
Mm, definitely.
So what this has done, as rogue results often do, if it is rogue, is lead to the need for more research.
Yeah.
which is
as
the way
always.
That it works.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, more research is needed, so watch the space. But, you know, it is an absolutely brilliant technique, and, you know, the people responsible for this will certainly be in line for a Nobel Prize.
Mm. But isn't, because from what I understand, I mean, there's new stuff coming out about CRISPR all the time.
Yes.
And isn't there so much research in favour of it? So just this little piece now that's saying, oh, actually, no. Mm. I don't know. I feel like that all of that positive stuff, should that not really outweigh this one small study that tested two?
Well, it shouldn't, if the small study was done correctly.
Mm.
You know, if it's beyond reproach, then just one, you know, negative result can kill the whole thing.
Yeah.
So that's why this does really, really need to be investigated. It needs to be investigated very, very quickly, and you can make damn sure that there'll be people beavering away in their labs around the world doing that right now, because potentially it's worth a bucket load of money, an absolute bucket load of money. And again, there's been big problems with the patent for CRISPR.
Yeah.
So these two women at Berkeley, and there's another group over at Harvard. And the Harvard people have been awarded the patent in the US, but the Berkeley people have been awarded the patent in the UK and in Europe, and so everything's all up in the air, and you can imagine that this really will be worth a truckload of money.
Mm. It really is a fascinating piece of technology, though. If any listeners are interested in learning more about this, there's a really great podcast from Radiolab about CRISPR. There's part one and part two. So one was done, I think, a little bit over a year ago, and then another one was done more recently. And just kind of covers what exactly this technology is, as well as that whole sort of battle for the patent as well, which is really fascinating. So if anyone wants to learn more, check that out.
Good idea.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for joining us this week, Alan.
Not a problem,
Have
guys.
Have a lovely week. We'll see you again next week.
Surely will. See ya.
That was Dear Science.